I'm Duncan MacLeod, and this is TCS Plus, the business technology show from Tech Central, which is brought to you today by OpenServe. Now, my guest today in this series of very insightful interviews that we're doing with OpenServe is Robert George, the company's chief network officer. And I always love chatting to the network guys in the telco industry because they really have a great feel for what's really happening on the ground. So, Robert, really good to see you. Thanks for making the time, and thanks for visiting Tech Central.
Thank you, Duncan, and thank you for the opportunity.
Pleasure. Tell me a bit about your role inside OpenServe and what it entails. What do you do on a daily basis?
So my role really, I'm kind of responsible for a dynamic bunch of engineers that really run the network. They are responsible for the network operations and service operations center. In addition, I'm responsible for the undersea cable network environment. And all that run, all that goes around managing undersea cable network infrastructure.
Okay. But maybe give us, if you don't mind, an overview of what the Telkom OpenServe network actually looks like. I believe the mobile side of things is managed by the retail business, but basically the rest of the network infrastructure sits under OpenServe. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. So you've got fiber to the home. You've got some legacy copper infrastructure still in the network, I'm sure. You manage the long distance fiber routes as well. And you mentioned undersea access. Am I missing anything?
Satellites? I think you're pretty spot on. You missed probably a small portion of satellite. Mm-hmm. Gone are the days where satellite was, you know, sort of a dominant connectivity player.
Yeah.
Undersea cables have really taken that role.
Okay. Good. Well, so what is your daily job actually entail? Are you running around talking to those engineers, directing them to fix problems? What is the daily role of a chief network officer? Take us into it.
Well, you kind of hit the nail on the head. It's really about managing a dynamic bunch of individuals. You know, we have a strong workforce in our network operations center, and they are managed by a team of what we call duty managers, and they're inherently the command and control of any failure, any major critical major or minor failure in the network, and they are responsible to then, you know, enable the engineers that we have in the field to the actual break site. If we have a fiber break, we dispatch our technicians to those sites or to the break, and then control and manage the actual repair process.
But you do this all using very fancy technologies. I've been to your offices in Centurion, and I presume you still have it there. This huge network operations center with these giant wall-to-wall screens that give you a picture at any given time of what's actually happening on the OpenServe network. So it's a pretty high-tech operation, and you can actually get a top-level view very quickly of what's happening on the ground, right?
100%. It's really based on best in the world-class technology. Those walls are quite impressive. Mm-hmm. I think probably the largest in Africa, probably in the Southern Hemisphere, I would say. And we're talking about 120. We've added to it, and probably 4 meters high. In fact, we've built a DR NOC in the Western Cape, the Milnerton area. It does exactly the same function. It has a similar bunch of really experienced engineers. And yeah, we're talking about millions and millions of alarms that get generated every minute, every hour, every day. Mm-hmm. And it's really about making sense of those alarm indicators and actioning what is not actually seen. I mean, we do a lot of automation, a lot of machine learning. And I mean, one can appreciate we're looking at over 100 million alarms on a monthly basis.
Good grief.
And the actionable events is actually significantly less. So there's a lot of benefit in centralizing your network management, and that gives you the ability to centrally actually repair many of the failures at a logical layer, for example. But if it's a physical issue, I guess, you know, we are very, very keenly integrated with our field force.
Yeah. But I imagine that a lot of the problems can be just solved with tap of a keyboard and something's gone wrong there, just a network configuration issue, that's fixed. You don't always have to dispatch a technician on the ground.
100%. Many times we are able to actually reroute traffic. And in fact, the way our network is designed, we've built a fair amount of resiliency and redundancy, and it is a lot of self-healing capability. So so if I have a break, any of the long-distance routes, it automatically reroutes. It's there's additional capacity. We've built in additional capacity that reroutes. And I'm not, I'm not talking about 1 gig and 10 gigs. I'm talking about 100 gigs and 200 gigabits per second, 400, 800 gigs per second. We're able to reroute and switch in milliseconds.
Right.
So that self-healing capability is really, manifested itself in our reliability of our network.
You mentioned machine learning. So you are using ML and AI tools to actually help you with that
self-healing? Yes, we started with that. We're looking at that quite aggressively to, we're always learning, trying to find better ways of managing and running our network. And yeah, I'm able to see at any point in time through apps that we've developed in collaboration with Pushkin and his team on any failures that I have in my network. And I can tell you right down to which technician is actually in the field, which service providers on the ground. Okay. I have that ability. Okay. I mean, I earlier spoke about the undersea cable repairs off the coast of KwaZulu-Natal. This adverse weather has put the ship in a holding pattern until they can continue safely repairing the shunt break that they currently is in place. So,
yes.
As I'd indicated, that we have two very skilled and experienced OpenServe technicians on board. So and even with the breaks we had in the West Coast, that cost quite a long and lengthy repair time.
I must actually ask you, there have been a significant number of cable breaks, undersea cable breaks around Africa in the last 18 months or so. Is it just my imagination, or has it been much higher than usual?
It is definitely much higher than usual, and incidentally, since COVID started and the huge demand on our network, I mean, Alton constantly challenges us to improve our network availability and the capacity. I mean, we had to cater for huge capacity increases. And 100% you're correct. We lost a few cables numerous times. And again, having capacity on two undersea cables is actually not good enough anymore. You need three and four. In fact, you're looking at additional capacity through other cable through South America, for example. So you need to constantly be monitoring the performance of your network and ensuring that you have sufficient capacity to handle such a break. I mean, we lost five cables actually, and we were still able to provide seamless connectivity through the Equiano Google cable, which we have a fiber pair on. So, 100%, excellent observation.
Yeah. We were saying a few years ago, if we'd had that simultaneous cable break, it occurred, I think it was off the Ivory Coast, where four cables were severed at once due to some sort of seismic activity under the ocean. If that had happened a few years ago, it would have been catastrophic.
Catastrophic, 100% catastrophic.
But now, because there's been so much investment in subsea infrastructure, 100%. That it's actually largely mitigated.
Correct, 100%, largely mitigated, and our partners, competitors in the industry are also pulling in their own cables. So there's quite a fair amount of cable infrastructure available.
Right. It sounds to me that it sounds as if we actually do need all of this cable infrastructure. It's not a case of what we saw around the era of the dot-com bubble in around 2000 in the North Atlantic, where there was a massive overinvestment in subsea cables. It sounds like, despite the huge investments we've seen in recent years, that the investments we're seeing certainly around Africa are actually justified.
And rightly so, and I guess the demand will be continuously increasing
with
all these new applications coming on board and all these hyperscaler technologies coming on board, and the demand for capacity and bandwidth is going to ever increasingly grow. We already have that in mind, and hence our investment in some of these cable infrastructures.
I want to come back to your network operations center, and you mentioned the new one you've built in the Western Cape as well, and just touch on load shedding now. Load shedding seems to be a thing of the past. We haven't had it as of this recording for about 155 days or so. Touch wood, it's not going to come back. but it seems that Eskom has had a structural shift in its performance, and it appears that it is on top of the situation now. I imagine that sitting in that network operations center in Centurion when load shedding starts must be quite a thing, because I'm sure the screen just fills up with faults the moment the power goes off. How have you been trying to deal with the scourge of load shedding in your network? What has historically the impact been, and what have you done in terms of investments to make the network more robust when the power does go off?
Yeah, so one of my additional responsibility is to lead the energy transformation in OpenServe.
Okay.
And yes, load shedding has brought a level of a different challenge into our the way our network runs. Traditionally, we've built networks over tens of years using standby diesel generators. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, individuals or people may think that these generators are pretty small. Some of them are 1.5 kilowatts. Some mm-hmm. of them are 2,000 kilowatt capable. We have certain sites that, and I think Alton alluded to that in his interview, we have sites that run around on 1.4, 1.5 megawatts of capacity.
Good grief.
So that standby generator needs to be able to handle that load. Yeah. And those generators do run to fail.
Yeah.
They run to fail. So load shedding has given us the ability to really focus on deploying lithium ion as a primary backup to the grid failure. And we've deployed well over 1,000 sites already with lithium-ion batteries. As indicated, it can handle up to between 4 and 6 hours of downtime.
Right.
To complement that, we're also aggressively pursuing solar deployment to complement, in other words, to charge the batteries during the day. And in fact, also power many of our sites with solar. This reprieve from Eskom has really enabled us to review all our standby generators. We've in the last 4 months been able to run maintenance schedules and repair and really just tender care to our generators. So in the anticipation that there is load shedding, but load shedding has really come in another form. It's come in the form of load reduction.
Mm.
So we've seen quite a fair amount every day, and I get a report every hour of the load reduction that occurs in the network. But I think what is probably more detrimental is extended municipal outages. As much as load shedding is gone, load reduction is manifesting itself quite dramatically, and is extended out. And this could be days. I mean, to run a generator for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, it's really diesel consuming. And if you burn the diesel, you don't get any additional benefit out of it. So it comes with a different dynamic. With load shedding, you can then architect a network and run a business case that says, let me install batteries. Yeah. And, you know, where there's a schedule, you know the batteries will run for 4 hours. You have an hour then to switch back to the grid, and you're kind of safe, and the batteries will charge. The next cycle, you're safe.
Mm.
It's these extended municipal outages that's really becoming problematic to manage.
Oh, interesting. How serious is the problem? You've probably got a better view than most of the extent of the load reduction issue in the country. I mean, we hear about it, but some areas just aren't affected by it. How widespread is it?
It is at a national level. It is all over the place. There are certain sites that run many days. I'm talking maybe even weeks without power, and you need to run the site.
But is that load reduction, or is that a problem on the ground?
It is a problem on the ground. You know, cables get damaged. Power substation get damaged, and they're required to be replaced. And that's extended time. And we can't afford to have the networks down. We continuously refuel the sites with diesel. Obviously, the bigger sites, we have a very large network footprint, and we categorize each site based on the importance, based on the services they offer, the amount of capacity that runs through a particular site.
Mm-hmm.
Our top sites probably consume 40% of our total power requirements. The bottom, smaller sites, we have really a strategy to manage that through battery deployment and solar. And that's pretty easy to manage. It's the bigger sites, we're looking at BESS type technology, large, high capacity, high volume batteries. Mm-hmm. They're not cheap.
Mm.
They're really not cheap, and they can handle certain parts or certain portions of a particular building. Yeah, it's a challenge, but we're there.
We know, and it's not just an open service issue, we know it's an industry issue, and that's theft and vandalization of infrastructure. Not just open service, operators across the board in South Africa have been deploying batteries, solar, other mitigation technologies to deal with load shedding. How do you secure all of that stuff?
Well, we've approached the industry, not necessarily always the bigger players. There's a couple of smaller individuals, small businesses that have really innovative ways of securing your batteries and, in fact, securing your solar panels. And I think securing your batteries is the most important. Panels, solar panels are becoming pretty affordable.
Yeah.
So
encasing it in concrete and all that sort of thing.
Yes.
I've heard some wild stories about
vaults. And we're introducing a sort of a visual eyes concept where we deploy high definition cameras at sites where they are problematic. And all that information gets brought back to the to our NOC, and we are able to use artificial intelligence to view who's on site, the vehicle that's on site, and the registration. So we kind of get a starting to get a good sense and feel who's actually entering your property in unauthorized access and helping themselves to some batteries. Yeah, even, I mean, just as simple as solar panels. It is, there's really some very innovative ideas in the industry, and we're deploying a lot of those, in, especially in the areas, in the provinces where theft is predominant. Yeah.
Right, right. All right, let's switch tack a little bit, Robert, and let's talk about what's actually involved in building a modern telecommunications network. And you're probably the best person in the country to talk about this because you have been through a massive network overhaul over the last 10 years. You've gone from a copper legacy to a future of fiber and wireless technologies. What is actually involved in building a modern telecoms network in 2024, and how do you make decisions about which technologies you use and where you decide to deploy infrastructure and how?
So let me take you back to pre-2010, when South Africa hosted the FIFA World Cup.
Yes.
Back in 2010, we were the fortunate company that was given the rights to build the network infrastructure that underpinned and supported the actual broadcast. We always experienced issues, but we built a network then already of minimum 10 gigabits per second to all the stadiums, to the broadcasting centers in NASREC, for them to be then fed internationally. So already we had the mindset of you need to go big or go home. Back in 2015, 2016, we looked at introducing and we started the actual implementation of the packet optical and transport network. And here we're looking at capability of handling 100 gigabits per second, 200 gigabits, 400, 800 gigabits. We're able to now, we have a lab in Pretoria, in Constantia Park, where we test every single piece of technology. So it's very key that you have the ability to test, to really drive hard the technology you intend to procure, how it integrates into the network. Is it scalable? Very important to have the ability to scale up, and pretty quickly we saw during COVID the demand for capacity was huge, and we constantly had to upgrade. Every week we would provide out an update on actual network upgrade. Every week it was significant, and this was at a national level.
This has been putting new switches and routers into the
network. So it is, in essence, leveraging of existing investment. We had, obviously, when you architect and you build a network, you always provision for extra capacity, and that was very eroded very quickly. So you need to constantly invest in that network and adding additional cards, looking at higher capabilities, but very importantly, reliability and customer experience was key to everything that we do in terms of building a network. Very, very key. So back in 2015, 2016, we started building the POTN packet optical transport network, and we have it running today, a layered architecture. We are now in the process of decommissioning many of the legacy-based technologies which were built over the last 30, 40 years. I was part of that build schedule. I mean, a legacy voice exchange one can appreciate. These are rows and racks and rows of equipment in a building could be 30, 40, 50 meters long and 20, 30 meters wide. And they are such power hungry devices. We have really managed to reduce that footprint down to a third, actually less than a quarter of what we had back in the day. So
Moore's law at work.
It is. And it's actually, it's a low light, but also a high light, because it's a low light to see an exchange that you've actually built and ran and run. You're actually now switching the thing off.
Yeah.
But the space that it creates, the opportunity it creates, it allows you to then, you know, you review your cooling requirements, you review your energy requirements. I don't need such a big, massive aircons to cool the networks. You can partition cabinets. You can partition. And there's so many. It gives you the ability to do so many other things.
Potentially even to build edge data centers.
100%. Looking at edge computing, exactly where we are. We have that ability. We have space now with all our decommissioning and network simplification. And you spoke about copper. Copper had its limitations. You know, with fiber, the reach is much bigger, so much further, much larger. So we are embarking on a massive network simplification program where I don't need so many sites. I don't, you know, the regeneration capabilities. I mean, fiber has a certain sort of lens it can provide efficient, effective communications with.
And now I believe you're going to complete that whole network or that whole forklifting of your copper infrastructure in the next couple of years.
100%.
Are you still running? I mean, we hear about, we know about residential technologies like ADSL. It was very successful at one point. Now it's a tiny fraction of what it was as consumers move to alternative, newer technologies. But are you still running legacy systems like Diginet, for example? And other leased line services, are those still concepts in the telecom OpenServe universe, or are those already gone?
We still have those. Our Diginet footprint has reduced significantly.
I'm sure.
I'm talking very significantly. Yeah. There's a few thousand of them left,
okay.
And we continually migrate them to different technologies. Yeah, interesting you spoke Martis. Martis is still a very powerful technology. Back in the day, really powerful, but it's
run its course. Remind me what Martis was again?
It's a Diginet technology.
Okay.
Dedicated capacity as it's synchronous technology, synchronous network connectivity. It's really a DSL sort of on steroids kind of thing.
Okay.
And fiber can complement and give you bandwidths in varying
magnitude. Yeah.
In orders of magnitude, 100%.
Yeah. So yeah. Is fiber the future?
Fiber is the future.
It's everywhere.
And as the world goes wireless, wireless goes fiber.
Right.
Yeah. It is. Without fiber, you
can't do fast wireless. Yeah,
you're kind of in trouble if you don't have the footprint and the reach that we have. You really need to catch up.
Yeah.
You really need to deploy, and deploying that takes a lot of capital and time.
Yes,
and it needs to be of a certain standard and certain quality. I mean,
yeah.
So yeah, fiber's key. Fiber's key too.
But as you go through this process of simplifying your network, it must also have a big impact on the reliability of the network as well. I remember my old copper ADSL line at home was always going down, or I was having problems with it. The speed was down. You know, I had to unplug the modem when there was a thunderstorm. You know, problems like that. I imagine that there's a lot less need for on-the-ground technicians to help with customers now that fiber is deployed widely, because I imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, that it's much more reliable.
Much more reliable. And our fault rate has dropped significantly, right? And, you know, our ability to actually be in the home and you know, Pushka spoke a lot about the OpenServe app and how that is, and how that has really given us the ability to really assist the customer to pinpoint in his home what is the actual issue, and in fact, able to report a fault, and we are able to manage it immediately. So you have two angles: you've got a network angle, and you've got a custom angle, and somewhere in the middle, you get to know exactly where your problem is, and you dispatch a technician with the right skills to the particular location. Now the failures that we have is less and less at customer level. It's more at aggregation points, right? So there's a larger footprint of customers getting back. It is easier to pinpoint, and obviously you know, react and repair and manage within reasonable timelines.
Yes. I imagine too that network design principles are very important in terms of reliability. The decisions you make up front in which technologies to employ in your network can have a big impact down the line on how many technicians you're going to need on the ground to service that network. Maybe just take us through that and maybe some of the decisions that OpenServe has taken over the years in terms of network design and how that's impacted you guys in terms of service reliability.
Yes. So earlier I spoke about the POTN network. So we started with the optical layer. We've built a level of redundancy and resilience. And we always build a fair level of backup, of additional capacity should there be a break at an OTN layer. At an Ethernet layer, more regionalized, we run on meshed networks. So if a path fails, it will reroute. And that also always requires capacity. In the IP layer, we effectively do the same. We have rerouting capabilities in the IP layer. At a logical IP layer, we implement. So we've got layers of redundancy built in depending on the services that you actually offer. So yes, we have very strict design principles. You don't run links more than a certain percentage. We had 50%, 60% before we actually tasked the engineering team to already start planning the next device or the next card or the next node. And that's kind of how we run. It's just really deliberate and diligently managing the performance of your network every day, every week, every month. That's key to ensuring you've got a reliable network and you have sufficient capacity. Yes, you have places where capacity, the demand on capacity exceeds your available capacity, but we have key partners. We have very two strong key partners which we rely on which we leverage to build additional capacity and pretty quickly and with the best quality and customer in mind.
Right, right. So you can move quickly if you see this demand has increased in an area. And
yeah, yeah. We
need to get in there and service that fast.
Yep, pretty much so. And yet, if you look at, for example, the way our network is architected, you may think, yes, you've got routes that are underutilized. It is by design that way. So when you lose a major route between Cape Town and Joburg, I'm able to route traffic through Springbok. I'm able to route traffic through Port Elizabeth.
Yes.
That is there by design. If you don't have it, kind of in a bit of a spot of bother in terms of your SLA offering, your reliability, where we pride ourselves on being the best fiber network in South Africa.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And just to touch on that, on the copper network one last time, I know that you're ripping it out and actually selling that copper. And the copper price, I think, actually touched an all-time high recently. It's been going through the roof. I'm not sure why. I think it has something to do with electric cars, if I'm not mistaken. What's actually involved in ripping that cable out? Because I imagine it's running under roads and across bridges and into buildings and it's all over the place. What's actually involved on the ground in taking copper out of the ground and recycling it or selling it?
Yeah, it's really an interesting thing. You know, in a legacy voice exchange, every single customer had a port and he had a pair of copper wires connected to that port. That all has to go somewhere. So those cables become huge. In an exchange, you've got major cable vaults. In fact, some of our sites where we had thousands of meters of copper cable has been replaced by 12 fiber pair, one fiber cable, two fiber cables. And the ability to actually extract that is quite interesting, you know. Our decommission strategy has really given us the ability to actually eliminate copper. Mm-hmm. And you spoke about martyrs. I'm talking about legacy SDH equipment. We had quite a fair amount of that. We basically had, I guess, the biggest footprint in legacy SDH technology. Not anymore. Yeah. A lot of that has been removed and continuously cleaning up our sites, decommissioning. It's not a grandiose job. It's not like building a new node that's fancy.
Yeah.
I think removing old and legacy technology and removing copper is kind of not fancy. It's not nice, but it has to be done.
Yes,
and you're right. The benefits of selling the copper is pretty huge.
There's lots of value in the copper, but I imagine there's not much value in that old equipment.
Even the equipment we are able to repurpose. We sell it. There are still some operators in some of the technology we have. There's still a demand for some of those cards.
Interesting.
And in the cards, there's still valuable materials in those cards. So, it's not only copper, it's that valuable materials. And there is companies that they actually come and we sell them a lot of our kit and they repurpose them elsewhere in the world.
Yeah. Interesting. I must tell you, I was a few months ago, I was driving back from the Kruger Park on the N4. I don't know if you know the section of the N4 where it splits into two. One goes through Schoemanskloof, the pretty route, and there's a quicker route that goes down to Nelspruit.
Yes.
I noticed, and it's not the only place I've noticed it, by the way, but I noticed at the top of Schoemanskloof heading back towards Joburg, or if you're heading the other way, actually, on the top of the escarpment there, there's old Telkom telephone poles running for kilometers and kilometers and kilometers along the side of the road. And all of the copper wires have been removed and it's been replaced with a single thread of fiber which runs along those poles. Is that a strategy to reutilize
100%.
Your pole infrastructure in rural areas to 100%. Avoid the cost of having to deploy that underground?
Yeah, correct. Yeah. And cost of underground is much higher than overhead. We are challenged. Some poles get taken out through accidents and through felt fires and that type of stuff.
Fire zone is a big problem.
100%. But we know where the hotspots are and we have deliberate programs to replace those wooden poles with concrete poles. It works. Okay. It really works. So, we leverage off that infrastructure. Yeah. It just makes sense to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, even on the route down to KwaZulu-Natal, the N3, we have that on poles and many instances underground. Our routes to Port Elizabeth are the same, overhead and underground. That's the combination we have, 100%.
Yeah, yeah. Take advantage of the infrastructure you have there.
It's much quicker to deploy.
Okay. Now, Robert, you're a networks guy, so I want to talk a bit about where we're going. And we've spoken about AI and ML, but let's maybe just reflect a little bit on where networks have come in the last 10 years and where you think they may be going for the rest of this decade and maybe into the 2030s as well. Is it just more and faster fiber? Is that going to be the story for this period going forward?
Well, I guess it's more about capacity, more about speed, more about latency. It's really about bringing the intelligence closer to the customer. You know, you spoke about edge computing, cloud.
Yes,
all of that. It's really bringing that capability. I mean, with autonomous use, the latency needs are very low, and our networks today are not geared up for that. You need to be able to connect your customer as close to them as possible and bring that intelligence to that particular point. So wireless is key, high capacity is key, and very important is the resiliency of your network. If you don't have this capacity that you can, you know, reroute and switch traffic on demand, you're in a bit of spot of bother. So,
But do you think we've seen the ramp up of network speeds into, I mean, you can buy a 1 gigabit per second service into the home these days. And presumably we've seen telcos in other markets starting to deploy 10 gigabit to the home. I'm not sure how much demand there is for that, but do you think that the nature of the applications that consumers are going to use is going to drive that sort of demand going forward? I'm thinking of, I know that Meta Platforms has sort of pulled back from its big focus on the metaverse, but presumably that was going to be a very bandwidth intensive service when it launched. Presumably it's still coming. Mark Zuckerberg still talks about it. We've seen Apple's futuristic Vision Pro goggles. Are these some of the applications, maybe holographic meetings and that sort of thing, that are going to drive demand for bandwidth going forward? Or do you think we've reached a point where, you know, maybe a couple hundred megabits into the home is actually sufficient?
Well, my personal views, I think a couple of hundred megabits is more than adequate. You give me a 1 gig service in my house, I certainly do not want to see my emails faster than what I'm already getting them. So definitely applications will need to drive that requirement. Mm. And again, we're starting to see some of that demand. We've deployed GPON technology. We're already looking at XGS-PON technology, and this is 50 gigabits of capacity back into the network. So it's a constant monitoring of the trends of the. I mean, we have probes all over the network. We're able to determine how much streaming traffic paid, different types of application, YouTube, Instagram, all of that. We're able to see how that is impacting on it. And we really started getting a good handle on that during COVID, and certain of those applications drove the actual demand. Yes, I probably was one of the first guys that said to my colleagues, 1 gig, the pressure that puts on your network to handle a service that demands a gigabit. As an engineer, we are cautious. We like to build redundancy, but it's very important to have that push and pull, commercial and the digital innovation pushing the network guys. And it's a constant push and pull of pushing us to deliver better services, higher speeds, better latency, and also never compromising on quality. Mm-hmm. Very important.
Mm-hmm. Lastly, I want to ask you about making these high speed connections available into areas where they haven't been deployed before. And I know there's some industry moves to look at deploying infrastructure in areas where it was just assumed a few years ago that it wasn't possible. Mm. Maybe just expand a little bit on how OpenServe is starting to push into the township markets and into areas that historically haven't even been served with fixed line connections, and whether that requires a different mindset in terms of network planning and building and that sort of thing.
100%. It requires actually a different mindset in terms of planning. Obviously, the footprint of the customer's footprint is much smaller than your leafy suburbs. So if you have a high density of population of need of either fiber connection, and so we have a deliberate strategy to provide fiber to those areas, to the underserviced areas, and it's doing pretty okay. It's a challenge, but we have decent connectivity, we have decent coverage, and it's through deliberate planning, building and integrating it back into the network. It's really about that. It's really more of the same in terms of fiber to the home deployment, just at a smaller stand sizes, mm-hmm. and technology is exactly really the same.
But do you deploy the fiber aerially, or do you trench in those areas? I'm imagining it's quite costly to trench in area where the margins are probably going to be quite tight anyway.
Even today in leafy suburbs, providing fiber to the home is primarily through the poles in the backyard, and from there the aerial cable into your premises.
Okay.
Yes, and there are bigger dwellings that we will then put it underground. We'll deploy it underground, but predominantly it is overhead. The last mile is overhead.
Okay. Are you able to use some of the ducts that you have in place for maybe historically for your copper network to just blow fiber through those ducts? Is that an option?
It is an option, but generally you find that it's been clogged up and blocked, and we prefer rather to deploy sort of standards-based ducts where you can blow the fiber in. It's really for ease of repair and that type of stuff. We do, but at very, very small, it's probably a very small percentage where we deploy fiber in existing ducts.
Yes.
But yeah, we would prefer to move on and sort of deploy completely new fiber link.
Yeah. And obviously, a lot of consumers will still connect via fixed wireless access and services like that, and even mobile services. But what do you think the ultimate market size is in South Africa for fiber to the home? Do you think there's still – I mean, there's been a land grab going on for the last few years. Do you think that land grab is now over, or is the opportunity still there to deploy at scale in the fiber space?
The opportunity will always be there, right? Yeah. And we have a deliberate fiber on demand strategy that looks at those areas where there is a need. And we go into an area, even if it's already overbuilt and we have a competitor there, we'll go into that area and we will start connecting house by house and expand. I mean, we don't go in and do the whole suburb, for example. We really start looking at it street by street, looking at demand, the marketing aspect of it and the app, using our app for actually requesting a service that has shown us where there is actual demand. And we already start planning ahead. Every year we have a fair amount of capex where we invest in deploying fiber, and again, it is in overbuilt areas. It is all over the place. So the opportunity is there and will continue to be there until there is some sort of market consolidation, I guess.
Right. Good stuff. Robert George is Chief Network Officer at OpenServe. Thank you so much for sharing these valuable insights with Tech Central. And a reminder: if you've missed any other episodes in this OpenServe podcast series, you can watch them by visiting techcentral.co.za/author/OpenServe or simply go to YouTube. Our YouTube address is youtube.com/TechCentral, and you can find all of these video interviews on the YouTube platform. Robert, thank you so much for making the time to come talk to Tech Central today. It's much appreciated.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.